From KLCC Media, this is the Oregon Grapevine. I'm Barbara Dellenbach. The Oregon Grapevine highlights fresh-pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live. Sophia Solano is the coordinator of the Restorative Justice Coalition of Oregon. Thank you so much for being on the Oregon Grapevine.
My pleasure, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
Let's just jump right into what is restorative justice?
The big question. I usually like to start by saying that every restorative justice practitioner would answer this a little bit differently. People who have been through a restorative justice process, of course, would also answer this differently. The way I see it, as a practitioner, and also as the coordinator of the coalition, is as an important alternative to systems of punishment. And so I think that restorative justice can be really effectively applied in a wide range of contexts. Members in our coalition are representatives of many kinds of organizations, from schools to the government. And the most recent forms of restorative justice that have been emerging in the state of Oregon have been funded by the state to actually build what historically might have been referred to as a diversion program. So actually creating pathways for cases that would otherwise be criminalized through the legal system to be rerouted through a community-based harm reparation process. So we use dialogue, and that is often consistent, whether it's in a school-based kind of preventative educational program or practice, all the way through to handling serious crime. We're using dialogue practices to build agreements with one another about how to move forward through difficult circumstances. That's about as quick as I could say it.
Let's get to kind of the practical aspects of how it works. A person, let's say, is driving drunk and something happens and a person is hurt. It's hypothetical, but I imagine it's also happened. How do you decide that this person, A, is the right candidate for restorative justice as opposed to not? How does that work?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And actually, currently, there isn't a standard of qualifying which cases should be directed. And I think that maybe I'll backtrack a little bit. Within each county, there are jurisdictional qualifiers. So for programs that are set up through the district attorney's office, they will have the ultimate power in deciding which cases are diverted and referred to the community-based process and which cases they want to retain. So often that might look like what is the extent of the criminal history of this person? Other times it might be what was the extent of the harm caused in that particular incident that qualifies it or disqualifies it. The programs that I have been a part of and have even been trying to build recently are working to have the widest net possible, if that makes sense. Like, we were really looking for which factors will qualify cases. And if we are noticing things that might be challenges or obstacles, we prefer to look to make accommodations and reframe by asking what would be needed to make this a good candidate for restorative justice. Another angle that's really important is how do the people affected feel about this being rerouted into the restorative justice program? Because if a victim or survivor of a crime are willing to be involved and participate, that will make the restorative justice process much stronger and usually much more resounding, I guess, in its impact. Like, the measures of accountability and the restitution or reparation even that can occur will be much greater because we have their involvement, we have their insight and even guidance into how that process should look. So for me, that feels like a major qualifier. If the person who's been impacted wants an alternative, that's the best case scenario for us. And we would start by interviewing, maybe even calling it an intake in a more formal process and see what the pathways are that can be used together.
Can you give a tangible example of how it might work? Is it that a person who, if we're using the drunk driver example, but it can be anything, of course, the perpetrator of the incident does this thing. What do they then do? They say, yes, we're going to do restorative justice. Are there art projects? Are there conversations? Are there mediation meetings? What is the form of restorative justice? Or and one example, I'm sure it's different, but what's an example?
Exactly. That is where it becomes a long conversation and sometimes a hard question to answer because depending again on which county you're part of, which resources exist there, what the referring mechanism is for how the case is handled, that will all influence what's possible in the case. But in my wildest dream, thinking about maybe in an Oregon where these services exist and are thriving already, the way I would hope it could go as a practitioner is at the earliest stage possible, it's identified that this is viable, right? So whether that's consent, I like to bring that word into the world of restorative justice. Do we have the consent of the person who caused this harm? Do we have the consent of the person who was affected by this harm to move forward in an intentional way? Once we get that agreement from both parties and maybe even other impacted parties, was there somebody else in the car who was affected? Would they like to be part of this? How would they like to be a part of this? It starts by just interviewing. And often there are three questions that we rely on in those interviews. And the first one is very broadly what happened. So we do a little bit of almost like fact finding. We want to hear from all of the parties that are involved what happened, what led up to this. And very often we hear things that we wouldn't expect or otherwise know, right? If you ask someone who was drunk driving what happened, you might actually hear a much longer story about how the abuse of alcohol has escalated in their life. Maybe a family member died recently and they're actually grieving. These are stories I've really heard during these first moments. What happened? How did we get here? The second question then is who was affected? And so if we start with who was impacted or what was impacted, right? Then we might also learn, well, this guy or girl or any person crashed their car. Right? That's actually a huge impact now that they're sustaining. So we find when we get into that second question, we have to start first with how they've been affected also by what's happened. And after that, we can start to prompt a little further. So what was it like when you actually made contact with this other car? Did you have an opportunity to speak to that person right away? How did the authorities get involved? Were the authorities involved? Maybe then we learn that there's a police report that we could eventually consult with if we wanted additional information. I found that, that can go either way. Like the police reports are also missing a lot of information, but sometimes they can be a useful resource. And the third question, after we've spent, sometimes up to 2 hours even unpacking and unfolding what happened and who and what was affected by what happened, then we can finally ask, where do we go from here? And often, especially if substances are involved, we like to be prepared to offer people a connection to resources. Is your relationship with alcohol something you want to give more attention to? How do you feel that alcohol is affecting your life? Would you like to speak to someone who's in a similar situation? Would you like to be connected to even some meetings or a treatment if it's at that level? But basically, finding an organic way to explain, this is having a harmful impact, but it's really in your hands how we work with this and how we prevent this situation from happening. And usually by that point, we're already in agreement that we want to prevent this from happening again. So what are the realistic ways that we can secure that? And after having an extensive interview, we would also, of course, ask the impacted party. And sometimes it would happen in the reverse, right? Like we would interview maybe the impacted party first so that we have that framework of where do we want to go from here? And I might even be able to bring those ideas forward to the person who's responsible. Would you be open to meeting the person who was harmed by this? I might ask, do you feel that your financial situation might be able to offer stability to someone who's now experiencing medical bills they weren't anticipating, right? So we can start to ask those questions about their basic needs also. I think that's something I really appreciate about restorative justice. We can't really do anything without having a healthy assessment of what are the basic needs of the people that we're involved with, because otherwise those will become obstacles later on. How is your housing? How is your work life? Do you feel in community with your neighborhood? How are your family relations? And if those things are strong, we will even invite them to become part of the process. And if the person is open to meeting the person that they've harmed, we would have support people also part of that conversation, often a community representative to think about the ways that the wider community, whether that's just the family unit or maybe the entire neighborhood, or maybe the community representative is actually someone who has also been in a hit and run and has experienced what it's like to make contact with an intoxicated driver and wants to speak to that, so that it's clear there's a wider rippling impact of public safety, right, when people are driving drunk. So as you can see, that dialogue, we often sit in a circle, that can become a pretty big meeting pretty quickly. And that's ideally, I think, where we see the most magic, if you will, happen, things that the facilitators can't even anticipate. We'll do our best to minimize surprises and have one-on-one meetings, of course, with everyone who's going to join that circle dialogue. But we also hope that the agreements that we reach in that space are new and genuine because of who's there in the circle. And so the facilitators often don't have a clear idea or outcome that we're pushing for in those meetings. We really want to be there to support the flow of communication. If additional meetings are needed, right? Maybe we'll spend 2 hours just getting to know each other, exploring the impacts, exchanging an apology. And then we might come back in a separate meeting with a document. Once we have a better idea from that meeting, what would be a good way to move forward? Maybe the facilitators will put a template together even that now we're reviewing, we're filling in the blanks together and actually signing something that almost always includes a clause about what if this doesn't happen? Also, what if the things that we're planning now aren't possible? How will we respond? Who will be responsible for checking in to make sure that those steps are being completed? So I was kind of hinting at this already, right? But in a situation with a drunk driver, that agreement might contain alcohol treatment, right? So the person agrees to even, or if it's not treatment, attend a handful of meetings to hear from other people who are struggling to control alcohol use in their life. It might also be direct reparations. If you experienced a medical bill of $2,000 that you weren't expecting, how can I make payments over time to help you with that cost? There are also programs in Oregon that have started receiving funding specifically to help people who have caused harm that they can't repay. There are some really beautiful kind of legendary stories in the field of restorative justice where I'm thinking of one, a couple of young kids are playing with fire and they accidentally burn down this huge bridge. This bridge is necessary for the entire economy of this small town where they're living. This is a harm they'll never be able to repay, right? But they can make small gestures. They can organize a fundraising event. They can show up with manual labor when the pieces are there, right? So really looking for what is possible, but also what is the obligation of the community now to show up and raise funds to rebuild this bridge because the whole community was affected. And so in a case like this, if someone's car was totaled and the person actually can't help that person get a brand new car, they don't have insurance to cover those costs, I'm hoping we will eventually have strong enough programs where we have the funds to help that, or maybe match funds, right? If the person who caused the harm can contribute $1,000, maybe the program can match that, either with the state investment or other mechanisms of income and community solidarity to recover from harm. So it's really open-ended. That's why it's also, I'm speculating, right, and hypothesizing, but you're exactly right. Restorative justice is always individualized. it's handled on a case by case basis, and that's something that sets it apart. It's very unique from the legal system, where in Oregon, we're actually locked into a sentencing grid. Not a lot of people know that, but especially with higher level crimes, the legal system does not have much discretion, whether it's the prosecuting attorney or the judge making the final decision. They're locked into a grid that also takes into account past criminal history, severity of the harm. And so this gives much more flexibility and discernment power to the people who are facilitating, and also the people who have been affected have much more power in these processes.
These are circumstances where there has been adjudication. There is someone who's involved already in the legal system. There's been a crime committed or whatever. And you kind of alluded at the very beginning of our conversation about education. Are there ways of doing restorative justice and learning about restorative justice and being involved with restorative justice before a crime, like in school, in just conversations about how to get along with each other, or you stole my pencil in class, whatever it happens to be that is not as serious a crime? How do you get people to learn about what this is and different ways of coping?
Absolutely. Yes, that's a great question. And I see them as very connected, because we also know that things like the school to prison pipeline still exist. We've been able to now like name it and observe what's happening, but we really haven't figured out a way to interrupt this pipeline. And we do know that in many cases, schools actually adopt the punitive systems of the carceral legal system, and they start even maybe matching kids with parole officers or bringing in school resource officers. This was something that was a very hot debate, actually, in the world of restorative justice for a while. Is this about building healthy relationships with between officers, official authorities, and youth, or is this about criminalizing and further punishing children in what should be an educational environment? So there was a very wide spectrum. People were even, debating down to the details of, should these officers be in plain clothes? Should they be armed and really presenting as a police officer in the hallways? So these very subtle changes and choices, I do believe, make a huge impact on the culture of a school. And so I tend to believe that the strongest forms of restorative justice in schools really embrace the school environment as an educational environment, right? When mistakes are made, are we punishing people, or are we using this as an opportunity to share information and ideally prevent this mistake from happening again? Even equip youth, right? Like you're suggesting, with tools that they may not have, especially around communication. Sometimes people are implementing over many years restorative practices in schools through socio-emotional learning. SEL, I think, is the acronym that's frequently used to talk about giving students skills in understanding their emotions, understanding communication as a way to move forward. Peer mediation, even, was a term that was being used for quite a while to teach kids mediation skills. So when conflicts appear, they may be less likely to need to rely on the authority figures in the school, and they might actually be able to just communicate about the conflict at hand, whether it's on the playground or in the hallway or even in the classroom. Can kids by themselves have the tools needed to communicate, I was affected in this way. I don't like it when you do this to me. I'm sorry that I affected you this way, right? There are adults that don't know how to make a genuine apology. So I think absolutely, by giving these skills to kids early on, we're setting them up for success in a way that will prevent them from entering the criminal legal system, ideally, but also other systems of punishment that exist within schools, disciplinary sanctions, right? We know that suspension actually even harms kids. Right now they're out of class, as if like, being in conflict with another student isn't enough. Now we're going to set you back in the academic world as well by forcing you to miss school or be isolated. Right? That's actually what the criminal legal system exists to do, also, is isolate people who are identified as the problem, and just hope that that separation is enough to change behavior. Very often we find that it's not, and things might even become worse. after. So circles are also used, I've seen, in schools to reintegrate students. So often there can be a blend, right? Let's say someone really hurts another kid and has been identified as actually like a safety threat within the school. I don't want to say that there's never a time to remove a student from the school environment, but if the school has decided, right, this is like the threshold of harm that would require a student to be removed from the classroom for an extended period of time, then a restorative justice approach would work to reintegrate that student eventually, right? So actually to have a dialogue between administrators, staff, the student, maybe also the family, maybe friends of that student who will be closest to them as they're reintegrating into the classroom, right? And so I think that can be a really effective blend, is when some disciplinary policies, often schools feel like they have to use those disciplinary policies that are enforced even by the state in response to certain crimes or harms on campus, then we can still use restorative practices to soften the impact and to reintegrate. And maybe there will still be a preventative impact because of that approach, rather than just dropping them back in and hoping everything works out. Does that
There,
make sense?
it does make sense. There are also, I know, in the country, and of course, each state is different, each place is different, but there are kind of restorative justice programs in prisons. I've heard about a couple. One recently that was a documentary has to do with making quilts with these guys are lifers mostly. They're making quilts for foster kids because they realize it's a restorative healing part of their work. Is there anything kind of similar to that in Oregon? Are the prison It's easy to think of prisons as just we're going to, put them there. They're not really the education piece of it is not getting funded, et cetera, et cetera. It's certainly not. We're really not trying to make it better. We're just trying to incarcerate these people. That can be the attitude we have. But I know we're supposed to be doing this other thing, supposedly. Is that happening in Oregon prisons at all or jails where there is this work going on?
Yeah, that's a great question. I want to say yes. Right away, I want to say yes, there is hope. I've actually had the immense privilege of entering the Oregon State Penitentiary to work with currently incarcerated men there who have started their own group, their own restorative justice group, to really be wrestling with these concepts, of course, in relation to their own life, their own story, and what led them to prison. But they're actually doing much more advanced work than just that to attempt to change the prison culture from the inside out. So these men that I've met that are leading this group have even developed a curriculum to work specifically with people who might be at risk of domestic violence, whether that's a part of their history or not. There's interesting data that suggests people who are leaving prison are more likely than they were when entering prison to become abusive, whether that's physical violence or other forms of domestic violence. These men created, I want to say it was a 15-week curriculum supported by the Circles of Peace curriculum at New York University's Center on Violence and Recovery. A wonderful facilitator, Crystal McCloud with NYU, came into the Oregon State Penitentiary. We went through a 3-day training with her to enrich and enhance this curriculum. And then these men, with just a little bit of outside community volunteer support, really ran this curriculum themselves and were helping other men learn about restorative justice concepts and principles, but went much deeper into the impacts of trauma, intergenerational trauma, cycles and patterns of violence and how they can be interrupted. There was even this breakthrough moment that happened in the training where we realized prison itself is a form of domestic violence, right? These men are experiencing violence constantly. They're in conflict with their cellmates often, that are quite literally roommates, right? And so as this violence is becoming normalized for them, it becomes a risk that this will be carried out with them once they are released into the world. And so, seeing that context as really part of the problem, what's even seeding cycles of violence back into our community, made us more inspired. And for me, there was also an ethical conflict. I'll be honest, I tend to see myself as an abolitionist. I believe that restorative justice can completely replace the systems of policing and prison that we have existing in the world today. But I'm one of very few, right? Like, we are a wide spectrum of practitioners. And of course, we have really, really solid practitioners and allies currently incarcerated, working in systems, working in government agencies also, that are working on smaller steps of reform. Going into the prison now feels like a form of harm reduction, right? Like, we know that harm is happening there. Harm reduction is also important so that these men who might actually be able to be released, some of them are facing life in prison, but others will be released. And so, seeing this as an opportunity to bring them back into the real world with skills and knowledge that can actually grow our field. There are examples right now, really good examples of leaders in the field of restorative justice in Oregon that have been incarcerated as youth, that have been incarcerated for serious crimes as adults, and come back with the knowledge that they've gained inside prison. OYA, I want to say too, Oregon Youth Authority has a lot of really good holistic programming for youth. There's a friend of mine, and he was at McLaren for quite some time, and they had a pottery program. And so my friend became a really talented potter, actually, while serving. I think he did 6 years in the Oregon Youth Authority before now he's been transferred to an adult corrections facility where, of course, there are very limited resources. So I think I'll close with that note. There's an interesting, and I'll just give my opinion, a problematic reality of this system of mass incarceration, right? Where it really just depends which facility you are at. We have private prisons in Oregon, we have state-run prisons in Oregon. So even that difference where you end up will completely affect what resources you have access to. So unfortunately, restorative justice is not available to every person that ends up in a jail or prison in Oregon. And often you have to kind of be replaced, even if you show good behavior or if you are showing that, you're making the most of your situation in a facility where there are lower resources, you might become a candidate to be transferred to Oregon State Penitentiary, for example. My understanding is that OSP has the most educational and rehabilitative services available of any facility in the state. It's also interesting because that's a men's prison. I'm not actually aware of what comparable or similar programs exist for women's prisons. Again, it just depends which facility. And it's hard for me to think that's a coincidence, but that's a side note.
What inspires you to do the work you're doing?
Wow, thank you for that question. I studied ethics as an undergraduate student. My first degree was in philosophy. I went to Pacific University and they had a really interesting track of kind of like modernized contemporary philosophy that's called ethics, society, and law. So definitely that educational foundation provided me with a lot of information about the current state of injustice in the world. And so I do think for me that became a primary motivator is looking at the ways that society strives to embody its ethics and starts with principles like public safety and accountability. And these are really important things we should take seriously. But then somehow along the way, we build these systems that are actually creating more harm than they are good. And so I think that's what has kept me engaged. Truthfully, it doesn't feel like charity work to me. It doesn't, for a long time, it actually felt like activism because I was not getting paid to do this work. I was inspired by wanting to change the systems of injustice that exist. And, in a past life, I was even like looking at systems of how we treat animals. I think there's an interesting parallel. I started getting really into like ecological, environmental justice and looking at the systems of incarceration, if you will, for livestock and how we are treating sentient beings. And then unfortunately, there are a lot of parallels actually to how we are treating incarcerated human beings. And so that just became a thread that I couldn't let go of. I was also really, really lucky to have early mentorship. I started in a peer program when I was still in high school. I was just looking for ways to kind of boost my resume, prepare myself for college. And I got connected with a nonprofit that I'm still connected with out in Lincoln County, Partnership Against Alcohol and Drug Abuse, PADA, as well as our community CDRC, Community Dispute Resolution Center. They're state-funded mediation centers in many counties across the state of Oregon, and those are natural home bases for the field of restorative justice. Mediation is often considered a little bit different, primarily because they operate in the civil sphere. But really, mediators make great restorative justice practitioners too, because we're using a lot of the same skills within the criminal sphere. So, by being introduced to our Lincoln County Dispute Resolution Center and PADA, who were collaborating on a teen justice panel initiative, I became just a peer support person in these circle programs where I was working alongside youth that were busted for really small, nonviolent first-time offenses, very often like MIPs. It was mostly about building trust with your family again after having some violation of trust. And so, or yeah, lying, communication, right? So that's how I was introduced. I'm someone who experienced discipline from the school system. I experienced discipline at home. I was always a little bit of a troublemaker. And so I think being introduced to these practices at such a young age helped me imagine something completely different about how we can support each other when things go wrong. And I just stuck with it. I caught the bug. I want to name my elder Mindy Baxter, who was a juvenile attorney out in Lincoln County for a long time. She was really like the primary person who built that programming out in Lincoln County and has continued to teach me so much over many years. Rusty Butler, a Siletz native, who also taught me a lot through his own story of being incarcerated, coming back out into the world, but also through his culture bearing. These are traditional indigenous ways of repairing harm, of communicating with each other in a way that sees the future and what's possible and prioritizes healing rather than exclusion and isolation. That centers ceremony even in how we're relating to one another. So having that early mentorship also has kept me inspired. They continue to be actually huge supporters and allies and teachers in my work and in my life. And so that's what comes to mind, keeping me inspired. Thank you for the question.
Thank you, Sophia Solano, for all the work you're doing and for some little bit of insight into restorative justice. I really appreciate you coming on to the Oregon Grapevine. Thanks.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to KLCC Media's The Oregon Grapevine, fresh pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live.